Hi, and welcome back to the Undisclosed Unfiltered series. We are back after, 8,000 years. It feels like a long time. We're back after a very long time. Most of the summer, many months. Now that we're on the other side of the Patricia Rohrer season, and I'm here as always with my colleagues, Colin and Mito. Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi.
How are you guys doing?
Gearing up for school to start. I think both of us are in different ways.
Yes.
Definitely different ways.
Me and Mito are like, how long before the children go back to school?
Countdown has begun.
Yeah, see camp ya. Is over too. Today, me and my son just staring at each other like, and now what? we got 10 more days. But yeah, and a lot's happened since we've done our last unfiltered episodes. Obviously, every week there's news to be talked about. And for those folks who kind of love discussing these, you know, like contemporary cases, like make sure you join our Facebook community group. Because folks post in there all the time and they discuss cases. It's a great place to keep connected on this kind of stuff. So anyhow, I think we're going to start off. Mito's got some updates from wherever we left off back in the spring. And then we'll get into some stories we want to talk about.
Yep. Sounds good. My update, my very common update is about Nancy Guthrie.
Oh God. Okay.
Unfortunately, the 84-year-old who was kidnapped back in February 1st from Tucson, Arizona, still has not been found. 6 months. It's crazy.
That's crazy.
That she's still missing. And, you know, honestly, there's not that much that's been updated. But the one thing that I've seen is that, remember the whole speculation around the ransom notes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, some new information that did come to light is that first ransom note that was submitted about the Bitcoin, $6 million, you know, what happened is, you know, they threatened that, you know, they'll kill her if it went unpaid. Well, the second note that came just within that same week, basically, allegedly, it said Nancy passed away due to her medical condition. And we,
what?
Quote, buried her in nature, and zero communication since then.
Oh, wow.
So that third ransom note that was in the news, that was that person who was, it was a fake ransom note. And that guy's, you know, in court for that.
Right.
So yeah, allegedly, you know, she's passed away, which I think a lot of us thought.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the family and their social media posts in the last, you know, few months has been more around return her, whatever it is, however it
tell
is.
Tell us like, where she is.
We don't need to know your name. We don't have to know anything. It's okay. Just give us, you know, quadrants, like, where is she? And just let us have her back.
That is really tragic.
But, you know, between the FBI and the Pima County Sheriff's Office, they've had over 50,000 calls on the tip line since that the image and video was released of the suspect. But still, no one's arrested. Nothing.
I don't know why it feels like, maybe because all of our cases are from, most of them are from, like, decades ago. It just feels like when something like this happens now, it's like, how is this possible in this day and age with the kind of surveillance we have, technology we have? It feels like every case should be like any missing persons, homicide. These cases should be so solvable so quickly.
Right.
I don't understand it. Do we start geotagging people is what I feel like at this point.
Soon enough. Yeah. Soon enough.
Yeah. Kind of geotagging ourselves, you know, a lot of, you know, people can track our iPhones or wearing a Fitbit or, you know, something that tracks us.
I mean, look, years ago, I did ask my kids' doctors, can I put a chip in them? I said, just till they're 18, then they can take it out. Yeah, in this line of work, you get freaked out by that. Well, that's really sad. I did not know about that. And hopefully they get some closure on this now. But yeah, it seemed unlikely she would have survived this long. Like in
condition. Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was speculation around like, oh, maybe she's in Mexico, and maybe she is. But so far, they haven't been able to locate her anywhere.
Wow. So. I mean, even getting her across the border wouldn't have been that easy. I mean, this is like a pretty conspicuous person, and everybody's looking for her, right? So, all right.
Yep.
Okay. How about let's go to Colin, and then we'll come back to you. Mito, I know you have another story you're going to share, but let's go to Colin next.
Yeah, so my case follows up on a recent discussion we had about jurors asking for trial testimony during deliberations. And a case last week I think should serve as a model for courtrooms across the country. And it kind of sheds a light on the ridiculousness of the current deliberation system in many courtrooms across the country. So this is a man named Thomas Fox. He's in New Jersey. And this is a case where he's pulled over. He is it determines to be that he is operating without having his registration. It's been suspended. He is also charged with driving under the influence and sort of unsafe operation of the vehicle. Okay, fair enough. Case goes to trial. It's a short trial, and jury deliberations start. A few hours into jury deliberations, the jury sends a note to the judge. Can we have court transcripts? There isn't a court transcript, so what you're allowed to do, and what we may do for you, is we can replay portions of the testimony for you, okay? In order for me to do that, we don't replay the whole trial. So what I need is that unanimously, that you all go back into the jury room, you're going to send me out another note of what portions of the testimony you would like to have replayed, okay? So it would be best if you told me which witness and what portions. And I need to be something that's unanimous, that you all agree, that's the portions you need, we can't replay it, etc. Jury resumes deliberations. This is 4:02 p.m. 45 minutes later, they come back with a unanimous verdict, finding the defendant guilty on all charges. Defendant appeals and says, look, obviously the jurors were hung up on at least one of the charges and wanted to hear a playback of the testimony, and it was improper for you as the judge to require us to be unanimous. Even if one juror wants to hear back some of the testimony, that should be the law. And so the Superior Court of New Jersey Appellate Division says, look, we're not going to speculate about what happened. Even though we kind of know, right? We had some holdout jurors. They wanted the playback. Other jurors disagreed. They assented and had a unanimous verdict. They say, we're not going to dig any deeper. Generally speaking, if jurors request to have playback or a transcript of the trial, the judge should confer with the attorneys. In the vast majority of cases, they should grant that request and should give the transcript or the recording, and so they reverse this defendant's convictions. Mm. And then the issue of, even if it's just one juror, the court says, in looking at this, you know, we're not going to rule conclusively. We do not decide here between whether a playback request must reflect the consensus of the jury or maybe made at request of a single juror. We see no reason to disagree with the defendant's position. If even one deliberating juror wants clarification of the testimony, that juror should be allowed to make the request. And so the ridiculousness sort of that we laid out earlier, Ravi, is we have jurors sit through trials, sometimes weeks, sometimes even months.
Yeah.
Many judges don't like them to take notes. When they go back to deliberate, many judges don't allow a playback or a transcript. And then, God forbid, the jury finds the defendant guilty and a juror comes forward and says, we got the times of the alibi and the crime screwed up in our head. We think this is a wrongful conviction.
Yeah.
Federal of Evidence 606B and state counterparts say, no, you can't impeach their verdict. And so I love this ruling by the court in New Jersey. I think even one juror wanting a playback or a transcript, it should be given. And I'm glad to see, while not going that far, the court in New Jersey saying that's sort of our presumption.
I agree. I think that's a great outcome here because, look, in it happens all the time that one particular juror might have one particular question. And mm-hmm. I've never heard a judge saying, until and unless all of you unanimously say that we all have the same question,
right?
Like, it doesn't matter if it's one juror or the entire jury. I mean, like, it's never operated like that. So it's really good. So is this kind of like going to be, this is precedent now? Like, this is what's going to apply? Or how does this work?
This is an intermediate appellate court in New Jersey, so the state could appeal it to the state Supreme Court. I hope they do.
Yeah.
And so this would govern somewhat, but state Supreme Court ruling would be better.
Right. Yeah. That would be a little more solid. No, I think that's a really interesting case. It's also interesting to me that this actually went to trial and the guy didn't just plea out or something.
Yeah, I think, certain charges were clear. At least one of the charges was maybe ambiguous. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, sounds good. But, I am starting to think more and more when I look at, like you said, I mean, like, look, we just finished the Patricia Rohr case and our listeners, we have listeners who say, I got to listen to every episode 3 times because they can't
Absolutely.
Catch. Yeah. Me and Jennifer Leahy, I started reading the trial transcript in this 2 years ago. And of course I can't retain everything that's in the transcript. That's why thankfully Jennifer, Tammy, we always kind of double, triple check because then sometimes you have the time to go back to the transcript. Sometimes you don't. But the point is, even though we have been in and out of these documents for 2 years now, you still can't remember it all. I do not, there's no way the jury can remember all the details are presented. So I feel like at this point, what happens is, much like an actual investigation, jurors are like, this is what my gut says. They just walk away with a general feeling one way or the other, right?
Yeah.
And I think we all kind of do that. I mean, I know, like, I've talked a lot about how I started watching the, you know, all coverage on the West Memphis case, right? Yeah. And every time I'd watch a documentary, I'd be like, yep, they did it. No, they didn't. Yep, they did it. It was just like a gut feeling, you know what I mean? Yeah. And that's all it is, you know, without having all the evidence, like, that's the best you can do. And so sadly, that's, I think, what happens in the deliberation room. I'm going to be honest. I have never been a numbers person. And for that reason, I have never been really good at like money, like managing money, creating budgets. I knew that this is what you're supposed to do as an adult. I kind of just never got around to it. It just seemed like way too much work. And that's why I was so relieved to finally be able to sign up with Monarch. Monarch is a personal finance app that tracks everything, all of your accounts, your investments, your savings, goals, spending, all of it. Now, here's the thing, you know, a lot of apps only tell you what you've already spent, but Monarch actually helps to set goals. It helps to map out big purchases and see if you're actually on track before it is too late to adjust. Monarch even has an AI assistant that you can ask anything about your finances. You can be like, well, how much did I spend on travel last summer? Or can I afford this vacation without touching my savings? And because I'm not a numbers person, I love their easy to read diagrams. It just helps me visualize exactly where my money's going every month and how I can kind of reallocate things so I can meet my goals. One of my favorite features also is Monarch's bill split. You know, when you go out with your friends and everybody's gonna like split the bill, all you gotta do is scan the receipt, everybody claims what they got, and then it settles you up. You do not need a separate app for it. As a single working mother, I've got enough on my plate. I'm so glad I don't have to manage my personal finances because I really never could, not the way Monarch does. You, like me, can now write your own money story with Monarch. Just use the code undisclosed at monarch.com and get your first year off Monarch Core half off at just $50. That's 50% off your first year at monarch.com with code undisclosed.
And getting back to the school subject we were discussing earlier, the attention span of emerging adults in 2026 versus when we were kids and further back is so much shorter.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Forget that. I mean, can you imagine? Forget emerging adults. I mean, me. I'm like 52 and I can, you know, I'm on Instagram way too much.
Right. I mean, you know, as a kid, you would sit down and read a 300-page book in one sitting and okay, fine.
You would.
Colin, no one's doing that nowadays. Yeah. Colin Miller did. Trial. I mean, 8 hours of a trial per day. I mean, you're zoning out there.
Well, and everyone is different, right? Mm-hmm. I might read something and already forget in an hour, and my son can read a whole book and regurgitate everything, right? So everyone also kind of retains information differently.
I just think given in the age of AI, this should not be that complicated. We don't need the stenographers. There should be an AI agent that instantly, you know, like gives you the summaries of every testimony and presents it.
I record my classes. 10 minutes after the class session is done, students can pull up the Zoom recording of the class session and watch back.
Why would judges not want the jury to have transcripts daily or depending on how long the trial goes on? Like, why not?
The old historical rule was judges want jurors to assess credibility of witnesses while they're on the stand. And so if they're looking at a playback or more likely reading a transcript, it's different than being in the courtroom. And in that moment, hearing and seeing this eyewitness testify about what they saw.
Yeah, but if while I'm listening to him, you know, testify about whatever, and then I go back and I'm thinking, yeah, he's guilty, and I read whatever, oh, I misunderstood what I thought I heard. And so that corrects my gut feeling, like we talked about.
Yeah.
I mean,
Even that is for jurors who are going to be that diligent, right? Mm-hmm. I think plenty of jurors are like, no, I know exactly what happened.
I'm good. I remember everything.
Yeah.
You see the message like in this case, right? I mean, obviously they were interested in seeing the playback.
Yeah.
And then 45 minutes later, it's, you have a unanimous verdict because they knew.
They don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
They didn't want to deal with like going through all that. And maybe there's a couple jurors who are like, well, I don't want to see it. I have my decision, right? Like, yeah, that's okay. Well, anyhow. Good on you. This is Jersey, right? New Jersey?
Yeah, New Jersey. Yeah.
All right. Good on you, New Jersey. Okay. I'll go next. But I will preface this, and I know this is a case many, many people are following, especially our listeners. I'll preface this with just like, for those who might have missed the news, about 2 months ago, I became a grandmother. And in our culture, when a woman has a baby, she goes to her mother's house for the first 6 weeks. She's taken care of by her maternal family. It's just so she can totally relax. I've witnessed this happen in Pakistan. And what happens there, I kid you not when I say the mother never leaves the bed. They'll just bring the baby to the mom, like, go ahead and feed it and then take it away. Like, she gets a lot of rest. That's how it's traditionally done. Of course, I couldn't really do that. But I did have night duty with the baby. So the last couple months, I got the baby at night. I love him so much. And I'm working through the day. So it's been hairy. However, my son-in-law comes on the weekends because he works out of state. So he comes on the weekends to stay with us. And he said something to me and to my daughter where we were like, excuse me, what? He said, now he comes from Pakistan as well, from this region up north. And he says, well, who sleeps with the baby? Like, he's like, is a baby ever sleeping with Sana? That's my daughter. And I'm like, no, he sleeps with me. And he's like, okay, that's good. Because, you know, blood for blood. I'm like, excuse me, what? What is blood for blood? What is that? Like, you know, me and my daughter were like, what does that mean? He's like, well, you know, there's the thing that happens. It happens sometimes with women. They demand blood for blood. I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. You're freaking me out. What he was referring to is apparently this way, like, it is a phenomenon that occurs in other societies and all over the place, in which a mother will kill her children in the postpartum period. And the way it's understood from, like, his people, like, wherever he's from, is that they say, well, the child made the mother bleed, so the mother demands blood for blood. So he even asked my daughter, when you sleep, there's no like sharp objects around. I'm like, are you kidding me? What are you talking about? So, you know, thankfully my daughter has not been experiencing anything like that. But many people, moms listening to this, I'm sure have experienced postpartum depression. And that is my lead into the Lindsay Clancy case, which is what I want to talk about today. And it is a horrific, tragic case in which a woman named Lindsay Clancy in January of 2023 strangled her three children, Cora, who was 5, Dawson, who was 3, and Callan, who was only 8 months old at the time, in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Okay, so I want to go through the timeline here and explain why this is even, I mean, the trial is ongoing right now. You can watch it. A lot of people are following it. But I want to go through the timeline of the facts of the case, and then we'll get to some of the issues. Patrick and Lindsay Clancy, they met in 2013. They got married a few years later in 2016. She's a nurse. And she had originally had, she had a daughter, and then she had 2 sons. And after she had her daughter, she had a little bit of anxiety, but, you know, and then after her son, the first son, she also felt a little bit, but it wasn't really terrible, like, you know, her postpartum symptoms. But after her last child, after having Callum in 2022, her mental health really started deteriorating. She was getting depressive, anxiety, and her big issue was insomnia. She couldn't sleep. So imagine having 3 little kids, you know, all under 5 at that point, and you cannot sleep. So what happened was, I'm going to go back to September 2022, which was a few months after she had the baby. And she was like, you know, so what happened was immediately after she had the baby, like the first couple months, she went into kind of a manic mode.
Right.
And she started exercising excessively. 5 weeks after she had the baby, she ran a 5-mile race. Her sister's like, she was not herself. She was very manic. She bought a Beachbody MLM. And then suddenly she just kind of crashed. Okay. Mm-hmm. And she started getting very depressed, could not sleep more than 3 hours a night. She stopped working out. And so she goes to the doctor, September 2022, she goes to the doctor, she's diagnosed with depression, and she's prescribed Zoloft. Not working. The dosage is increased. she had even worse adverse reactions. At one point, she did not sleep for 48 straight hours, okay? She had racing thoughts, anxiety, and what they found was, well, in the reports, they say she had medication-induced activation consistent with bipolar disorder. This is maybe the first time the issue of bipolar disorder, I think, comes up in her medical history. Anyhow, she still can't sleep. She's taken off the Zoloft. She switched to Ativan and Benadryl to help her sleep. Doesn't work. Then she's given Trazodone. Doesn't work. At some point, her mother-in-law contacts this postpartum center for help. And Lindsay tells this nurse, "I'm terrified. I've got insomnia. I'm just deteriorating." Then she's prescribed Prozac, which made her insomnia even worse. That gets discontinued. Then she keeps asking for help. Then she's prescribed Ambien, Remeron, and Klonopin. The Remeron makes her start disassociating, and she's disoriented. A new nurse diagnoses her with bipolar disorder and prescribes her Seroquel. That is when she develops suicidal ideation, starts having intrusive thoughts and auditory hallucinations. She tells her family, her husband, her doctor, she's having panic attacks. She's lost 15 pounds. She calls a suicide hotline for help. She's told there was no emergency because she had no immediate plans to hurt herself. December 2022, she again meets another clinician. She's trying to get inpatient treatment. She's told she doesn't meet the criteria. Her husband reaches out and tells the same nurse who prescribed the Seroquel that it made his wife worse, and all she did was increase the dosage. So now her depression gets worse, she's debilitated, and thoughts of harming the children become part of her intrusive thoughts. December 20th, 2022, she goes to the emergency room. She admits herself to a partial day program for postpartum. She is given some kind of assessment, and she's rated as severe on postpartum depressive scale. But for some reason, their doctors say she's actually not bipolar, and they didn't think she had postpartum depression. They thought her symptoms were because of over-medication. They discharge her after a day. December 30th, she again admits herself to a hospital, a psychiatric hospital. She didn't get to see a doctor for 4 days because of the holidays. They stopped the Seroquel, and she's given Trazodone again. She's discharged after 5 days. Now, this, she was told, is like one of the best hospitals, best treatment she can get. At this point, she's feeling like, I have nowhere else to go because she's tried everything. After she is discharged, she is again diagnosed with chronic depressive disorder, and the doctor says her condition is deteriorating. That is what's in his notes. And then she starts having hallucinations. She's prescribed Valium. Then she's prescribed amitriptyline. On January 23rd, she does not sleep all that night. And the next day, she kills her 3 children. Okay, so I want to talk about that day. According to testimony and according to the state's charging documents, what happened was on the morning of January 24th, 2023, she had a telehealth visit with a psychiatrist. During that visit, she did not report any psychotic symptoms, although in the month prior, she had been Googling and researching, what does it mean to be psychotic? She's feeling psychotic. Around 3 o'clock, apparently she went out to run some errands. She came back home and she says she sent her husband out around 5:30 p.m. to pick up food and a prescription from a local CVS. And then she was left alone with the children. According to Lindsay, she heard a commanding, loud male voice say, "This is your last chance. You have to kill the kids and kill yourself." Anyway, before that happens, her husband calls, and he calls from the CVS, but she doesn't pick up. She calls him back. They speak, and he said that she sounded busy, but fine. He says he returned home around 6:05. He called out to his kids, the family, heard nothing. His kids' bedrooms are empty. He finds the master bedroom locked, breaks into it, and he finds blood throughout it. The bedroom window's open, and he looks out the window, and his wife is lying on the ground outside the window, face up. She has deep cuts across her wrist and one cut across her neck because she tried to kill herself. When he asked, he rushes outside, asks where the kids are. She said they're in the basement. He of course, calls 911, but he waits with his wife until they come, and then he goes to the basement to check on the kids, and he finds all 3 of them with workout bands around their necks. They're unresponsive. Cora and Dawson, the 2 older ones, the ones who are 5 and 3, were already deceased. Callum, the 8-month-old baby, was in critical condition and died a few days later. Lindsay was seriously injured from the fall. She is permanently paralyzed from the waist down. Now, she has been charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, and the trial began on July 20th of this year, so not too long ago. Her defense is an insanity defense, postpartum psychosis, and the state says it was premeditated because she sent her husband out of the house. She had it all planned out. And so, you know, at the heart of, now, there's also some questions, by the way, about the actual timeline, because there's some weird stuff going on with the husband's timeline. When he testified, he said, you know, and, you know, by the way, there's civil suits against like all these different medical providers. The husband filed, she's filed civil suits saying that she tried again and again. She was denied treatment when she was asked for better treatment. Like, you know, she reported again and again. Like, she clearly did everything she could to get help. I don't know what else she could have done. And she just was turned away and she was continuously discharged. And anyway, so look, I don't even know if it's worth getting into some of the questions around, you know, there are people who are like, oh, the husband was involved in this because of the timeline's off. And he was home because this email was sent apparently from the home computer, that the email was sent at a time that he was supposed to be out of the house. Also, the home has cameras, that Wi-Fi cameras that apparently captured nothing because he said the Wi-Fi was out that day. And folks are like, well, that doesn't make any sense. I don't know. I mean, look, I mean, there are people who, but he's not charged with anything. All right. So I'm just going to leave that aside. Now, the issue here is the question of whether this was postpartum psychosis versus a premeditated. I mean, I honestly, to me, it's actually wild that the prosecution has brought this case and they, given the set of facts that are so clear.
Seriously.
Yeah. So what do you guys think? Have you been following it? What do you guys think?
I've been under a rock. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've obviously, you know, seen the headlines and this, that, and the other, but I didn't know this level of detail. So to me, I'm just surprised that she went to so many different places, so many different times trying to get help, because I don't think we normally would do that, right? Like, I think I would go a couple of times and then I'd be like, all right, well, whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if I'm in that state of mind. So the fact that she went so many times to get help, tried this medication, tried that medication. I mean, obviously I'm not a doctor, but you know, what started out as postpartum, just, you know, I need some kind of support to help me get through this, ends up being just one strong medication after another, I don't see how that wouldn't kind of do something to you. Right. Cause is there like a break in between these medications? If you
absolutely
take one
not.
One day and another one day, like, does something else happen? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I feel like that.
It just, it doesn't
tons
seem
of
like
variables there.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there. And she was actually very good about taking the meds. It was not like she skipped taking the meds. She even documented her taking the meds. Her husband knew. Her family knew. They were all kind of like on this journey with her. And she was consistently reporting back over and over. Now, a lot of her visits were telehealth visits. So there's that. But hello, that's how insurance works nowadays.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, that means nothing. Telehealth or in person. It's a visit is a visit.
Colin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. And so I teach a case on insanity. It's out of Greenville, South Carolina. I'm going to read the blurb from my casebook that I use my students. And this is a case where in South Carolina, the prosecutor said, we stipulate she is not guilty by reason of insanity. So Donna Brown beats her 16-month-old son, Nathan, to death. Days before the fatal beating, Dr. Crumpler examined Donna in the ER of Greenville Memorial Hospital, diagnosed her as suffering from acute delusional psychosis. Donna was treated and given the drug Visteril. Soon after she was released, Donna began racing around the house and singing a hymn. Her husband found this disturbing and tried to restrain her. During the struggle, she went limped, prompting the husband to call 911. While the husband was calling 911, Donna got up and beat her son to death. On those facts,
God,
pretty comparable to the Lindsay Clancy case. Prosecution here in South Carolina said, we stipulate, we agree, she is not guilty by reason of insanity. And I just,
why'd they bring
shocked.
The charges, though? I'm confused.
Right.
The charge would be murder. I mean,
no,
be...
so no, they charged her and then they stipulated she's not guilty.
Correct. They charged her and then she said, I'm not guilty of reason of insanity. And that was the end. And she brought a lawsuit against not being involuntarily committed. And so that was a separate civil action. But yeah, I'm shocked in this case that the state did not agree that she meets the standard for insanity.
Do you know what the standard is in Massachusetts? Should we look that up real quick?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to be the McNaughton standard, which is an inability to distinguish right from wrong. My question is, does it also have irresistible impulse? Because some states have that and some states don't.
You know, what's interesting is watching some of these debates online about it, and people are saying that the fact that she kept trying to get help meant that she actually knew that she was actually in her right mind. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it's this weird double-edged sword that if she was actually psychotic, she wouldn't even know that she's psychotic. What do you think about that?
Well, this is interesting. I just looked it up. So Daniel Medved, who's been on the podcast before, he's a law professor. They don't use the term insanity in Massachusetts, which I can see. They use lack of criminal responsibility.
Sure.
Because they lack the capacity to understand that their actions are wrong. So that's the standard there in Massachusetts. Lindsay Clancy lacked the capacity to understand that what she was doing was wrong in committing these
acts. What do you think about the fact that she... that, you know, that she killed the children while the husband was out. And according to both her, and she doesn't deny that she did this, but according to both her and the husband, she asked him, can you go out and do these things? What do you think about that?
I mean, look, you can argue what you want. I mean, my case in Greenville here, I think she faked going limp. He called 911. She took the opportunity to fatally beat their child. I mean, I don't think it's that different. If she is in this state of psychosis, you're not thinking clearly. So I however you want to characterize it, it's disorganized thinking.
But does he never go and pick up meds from CVS? Like, is this the one time he ran an errand?
He goes to work as well, right? I mean, like...
Right, so like, it's not like he's always around her. He only goes to work and he never runs any other errands. Like, do we know that?
Yeah.
Because if she said, can you go grab this stuff? It could just be another errand that he typically runs or that she wanted him to run.
Yeah. Well, look, the trial is ongoing and, you know, I saw something else and I thought this was odd that apparently, I think there's two prosecutors in the case. What just happened? Maybe somebody just went mute quickly. Okay. Apparently there's two prosecutors. I think there's two prosecutors and one of the prosecutors, female prosecutor, every day she's been wearing a big old bow in her hair and people are saying that she's wearing the bow in the hair to remind Lindsay of her daughter or to, I don't know, to sign, which, I mean, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't understand. Colin, what do you think about why they're doing this though?
Why she's wearing the bow?
Why do you think they have decided to prosecute this case? Given the facts that I just read.
I mean, they might be worried about creating a dangerous precedent, right?
I also think it's because in general, there's very little information and knowledge about postpartum,
true,
you know, struggles that women have. Our postpartum care is woeful. My sister lived in England for many years and she had all three of her children in England. And it's just a matter of routine that they send nurses to the home for like 3 months or I don't know how many months afterwards to check on the children, check on the mother. There is so much more postpartum support. We're also living in societies where, unlike in indigenous cultures and Eastern cultures, you do have a village. Like my daughter came home to me. You know, she's not alone in this, right? Like and most women are very alone in child rearing. So if you can't sleep, if I can't sleep for 5 days, I'm going to experience some symptoms myself. You know what I mean? But I do think there's a profound lack of just understanding this condition. And it's tied obviously to the lack of medical research and attention women get anyways. Anyhow, Mithal, look like you had one say something.
Yeah. So since they're saying they're claiming that it was premeditated, was that life or would it be? Like, what would the sentencing look like?
It would be a life sentence in Massachusetts. They don't have, I don't think they have the death penalty in Mass. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Okay. We're going to continue to follow it. Update maybe next week.
Yeah.
And I will now pass it on to Meatball. What do you got for us?
I have another tragedy to discuss.
Yay.
Another, you know, case that I'm sure most people have heard about out of Mississippi, the case of Nolan Wells. For folks who don't know, here's a quick summary. So a group of four guys who are high school friends take a boat trip off the Mississippi Gulf Coast because they're going to attend a 4th of July beach party. One of those boys was 18-year-old Nolan Wells. Eventually, they returned to the mainland, but mysteriously, Nolan did not. The friends later called Nolan's family to let them know, like, hey, we don't know where Nolan is. And authorities were contacted and a missing persons search was initiated. 2 days later, on the 6th of July, Nolan's body was found face down in the water. The preliminary assumption that was made by the sheriff was that Nolan drowned. When he was asked about it, he said, quote, no foul play suspected. And obviously that sparked immense backlash for a number of reasons. One of us being, well, given Mississippi's racial history and the fact that Nolan was black, his friends were white, there's a lot of questions around the whole thing. An autopsy was conducted by the state ME, and that is sealed and will be presented to a grand jury eventually. The Wells family, given their doubts, didn't trust that autopsy, so they had an independent one done. Where the cause and manner of death was listed as undetermined. Now, I don't know how much we want to get into what Nolan's friends said when they were interviewed or the release of the audio, some audio just a few weeks ago. But, you know, as it stands right now, there's obviously people that say like the friends were in on it. The friends say we had issues with our boat. We made a call, a distress call to get help because our boat was sinking. The friends had his cell phone and his keys. So, you know, some people are like, that's suspicious. But on the flip side, when you go on a boat, you put all that stuff away. So, you know, the investigation obviously is still underway. And until they can present to a grand jury to determine whether or not there's any criminal wrongdoing or negligence, like, we don't know yet.
Right.
But while that's happening, there's multiple defamation lawsuits that have been filed by the attorneys that are representing the three friends. And I mean, tons of people online obviously are chiming in, and there's plenty of online vigilantes. And so people have actually been arrested. A few people have been arrested for making death threats. And so that also is on its own kind of path for potential prosecution. So, you know, again, I don't know. First, have you guys also been following this case?
Well, like you, because, you know, we've been really deep in the Patricia Rohr stuff. I've been reading the headlines and just following some social media, but I don't know a lot of the details. I think what I've just been confused about is how does something like this happen without foul play?
Yeah.
Like, that's what, well, somebody explain that to me.
Absolutely. No, I mean, and I think that's the thing, right? When the sheriff said no foul play suspected face down, I think the journalist who had asked him that question was like, he was fully clothed, right? And he said, yeah, but actually he wasn't. So yeah, it is questionable. And they should have, actually, I don't know if that was the sheriff or it was an attorney. I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up. But yeah, there was some misinformation out there. And so it's definitely still kind of very suspicious. And that's, I think, why Nolan Wells' family is kind of doing their own thing. They hired Ben Crump to represent them. And so they too are, you know, subpoenaing the social media platforms to get information on location data and any other, you know, tracking information that they can get, be it of Nolan or the friends. And in terms of the friends, like, they're, the four boys were together, but we're talking about a beach party that had 20, 30 people there, right? So there were multiple boats that were going there. These guys just happened to be on the one.
Wasn't there some video footage of them having a fight?
There was. And even that, right, there's speculation because somebody was like online, people are like, oh, that's Nolan's voice in the background. And then a different friend was like, that's me in the background. Like, that was not him. And so, again, there's just a lot of speculation online and people chiming in, and they're not always right.
The post-incident behavior, I guess, I know we say that, you know, behavior is not indication, should not be considered indication of guilt, but does it look like there's any collusion between the other boys? Like, they're kind of getting their stories straight? And
well, there were conflicting stories from the friends immediately after. But these are friends that, you know, at least two of them
were they all drunk?
Claim to be their best friends. Toxicology report is not back yet.
What?
So toxicology report
How?
Is not back.
It's been so
I don't know.
Long.
Exactly. It's not back yet, which is crazy. And, you know, there's a $100,000 reward for any information that the family's put up, the family side has put up. But yeah, I mean, Nolan's mom is like, she has taken over his estate. And so she's like, I'm going to be prepared to file lawsuits left and right, you know, depending on what comes of this for any wrongdoing.
Colin, what do you think?
I mean, it reminds me of, do you two remember the Kendrick Johnson case?
Yeah.
Out of Georgia. This was like in 2013 where he was like the high school student. He was found rolled up in the wrestling mat at the gym.
Yep.
And I don't even know how that actually eventually resolved, but it sounds similar in the sense of that was kind of brushed off and we don't know what happened.
I mean, you know, I actually did we did a bit of a deep dive on that case on Robbie and Ellen Solved the Case.
Okay.
And it really did look like it was a tragic accident. I know it sounds crazy, but it really did look like, because the cameras just show that there was just nobody else around. And that he had dropped, like, you know, these mats were rolled up and standing straight, that he had dropped something. I don't remember. He had dropped something down and then he had tried to crawl in and get it. But this is reminiscent of, like, I feel like I keep seeing cases left and right of, like, this young black person found hanging behind this and this young black person. And they're all like, oh no, it's self-inflicted or accidental or, and what was that one case in which this woman was at a party, the black woman was at a party with a bunch of white friends, and they find her dead outside the next morning. You guys remember what I'm talking about? I can't remember the name of this, the victim, or I don't know if she was a victim, but that also was, called accidental.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think the big issue is that it feels like they very quickly jump to, like, dismissing, like,
making
any
assumptions. Yeah, absolutely.
Dismissing any foul play. And I think that's the issue.
Yeah.
At least this investigation is ongoing. It's not a closed case, right?
Right. No, it's definitely ongoing. And you know, the sheriff then obviously retracted and was like, okay, I shouldn't have said that. But yeah, you shouldn't have, because you just started, like, you just found his body. Why are you already deciding anything or speculating at all?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it's crazy. It's, but you're right, Rabia. Like, there's so many stories, you know, that are similar to this.
Yeah, I mean, I just saw this Tazia Fortune. She was a 29-year-old black woman found hanging from a tree in Mississippi, and I saw this one, black social media influencer. She's like, I mean, it's a bit of a generalization. She's like, black people don't hang themselves from trees. She's like, it is, you know, on their own. This is not something we do. But it seems like it's happened quite often just in the last 6 months. I've seen at least three or four cases, which is wild to me.
Yep.
So,
yeah, I mean, in this case, like, the friends were like, oh, he stayed back to talk to a girl, and his family is like, there's no way. Like, he knows whoever you go with, you come back with, and we don't ride solo and do all that kind of stuff. And I assume that's because you are in Mississippi and there is history there. And so they're very adamant about there's more to the story.
Well, I mean,
than
okay,
that.
So just in case I miss a detail, he drowned. There's no other signs of, like, foul play, right? Like, there's no injuries on him or.
There's one red mark on the back of his neck, but the independent autopsy couldn't say if that was from doing the autopsy or if that was from, like, the transfer or something else. So that was kind of inconclusive.
Okay.
And their cause and manner was also undetermined.
Oh,
we'll see what the
really?
Actual states. Yeah.
They have not determined the manner of death, that the cause of death was drowning?
No.
Okay.
No. The cause and manner was undetermined. Mm-hmm. And then we don't know what the state's autopsy says.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on that, Colin?
It's tough in these drowning cases. I mean, we saw that a bit in the Amanda Lewis case, where you have marks from retrieving the person from being in the water, attempts to resuscitate.
Yeah.
And so you often have these marks, and it's really tough for an MA, which is maybe why even the independent autopsy is saying we don't know, to determine, like, are these marks something that happened during the drowning to cause the drowning, someone was harming them, or attempts to rescue or resuscitate.
Yeah. And even to play devil's advocate, like, sure, if you find a body face down that you know, he's naked, that can tell you something, or you can speculate and think one thing. But at the same time, if indeed he was drowning, you're not going to want to be dressed because that's going to weigh you down. Right. So
exactly. Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Well, thanks, Mito. I'm sure as the case unfolds, it feels like it's been ongoing for a while, like the whole summer, right? Like it feels like it's been.
Oh,
kind of
definitely. But it's because there's so much going on with, like, I think the public and the whole, like, online vigilantism is what is kind of distracting so much from them just kind of doing what they need to do to figure out what actually happened. The fact that there's three different paths here, right? You've got your prosecutions for people that are making death threats. You've got your lawsuits for defamation, and then you've got the actual investigation.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild. All right. Okay. So before we wrap up, I just want to kind of give a call to action to our listeners. Back, I think it was in May, we had attorneys for Tyrone Noling on the show. Tyrone has been granted an interview and a hearing for clemency. Now, I spoke to Tyrone yesterday, and according to him, like, nobody ever gets, like, this kind of interview. Like, it's his interview was today. I have no idea how it went. I will probably hear from him later, but his hearing is August 18th, and the ask from him and his attorney is, number one, you can go to his website, tyronenoling.com, tyronenoling.com, to read the application for executive clemency. You can also write to the Ohio Parole Board. That information is also on the website. And you can call the Governor Mike DeWine. And here's the number to call to support, because the Parole Board is going to make a recommendation. It's going to go to the governor then. So the governor's number is 614-644-4357. Once again, it's 614-644-4357. And call and tell them that you support Tyrone Noling's petition for clemency.
And we'll put that in the show notes as well.
Great. Excellent. Thank you, Mito. And we can put it on our social media. All right, guys. Thank you so much. We'll be back next week with a very interesting interview, I believe, right? That's what we're doing? We've guests. We have an interesting guest
we
for
do.
Next week. All right. Sounds good. All right, guys. We'll have a good rest of your week.
Bye.
All right,
thanks.
Take care.
Bye.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer three simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions, because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered one or two. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with three different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being a dollar, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.